You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Okay, good morning and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm Marina Ottaway, the director of the Middle East program here at Carnegie. It is my pleasure this morning to introduce to you Governor Karim, who is the governor of Kirkuk, to discuss the future of Kirkuk. As you know very well, Kirkuk has been a central issue in Iraq for a very long time. It remains a central issue. If you have had time to read the newspapers this morning or listen to the news, you know that there was three bombs exploding yesterday in Kirkuk, making a considerable number, causing a considerable number of deaths. We also all know that the future of Kirkuk is not defined, that Article 140 has never been implemented, that the discussions on how to implement, when and to implement are still ongoing, but for the time being we have not seen any solution to the problem. Governor Karim has been governor of Kirkuk since March of this year, and he was previously elected as member of parliament in the 2010 elections. He has been active in the Kurdish opposition in Iraq, I would say forever, reading your CV.
Fortunately, you don't have a choice there. You have to be opposition.
That's right, okay. He was elected to a steering committee at the London Conference of the Iraqi Opposition prior to the American intervention. He's the founder and president of the Washington Kurdish Institute and also serves on the board of director of the Kurdish Institute in Paris. In 1992, he worked with the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and State Department to establish the Voice of America's Kurdish Service. Karim is also a founding member of the Kurdish National Congress of North America and served as its president from 1991 to 1999. He was the first Kurd to be officially received by the U.S. State Department. And I'm very pleased to have him here. I don't think we could have a better person to brief us on what is happening in that region. Governor Karim.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate the invitation to come here before the distinguished audience here, and I'm so glad to see so many friends from years ago in Washington. I really don't feel like I've been away from Washington. It's only about a year and a half. I even see my colleague here from the hospital, Dr. Ali Khan, who we have worked together for many years. But I'm very happy to be here. As you mentioned. We had a tragic event yesterday in Kirkuk, due to terrorist attacks in three different places, which resulted in 29 people dying from their injuries and about 90 people wounded. And actually, probably today we will have some of the wounded transported to Turkey we're grateful for their offer to help, and some of the wounded will be transferred there for care. It's not easy to get so many wounded suddenly in a place where we still have challenges as far as the facility, the help that they can get in those places. I don't want to get too much into the history of what has happened in Kirkuk. Probably most of you know. But until 2003, specifically from the early 1960s, the process of ethnic cleansing started in basically 1963. I was very young at that time, and I saw with my eyes how they came and actually erased neighborhoods. And this continued and intensified under Saddam Hussein's regime, to the point that at the end it did not only involve the Kurds, but it also involved Turkmens. And they even denied the existence of Turkmens in Kirkuk, and they forced people to change their nationalities. Since 2003, of course, we have a new face in Kirkuk. And during this period of time, there has been changes. There has been changes in form of internally displaced people. People who were evicted for ethnic reasons have mostly come back. The people who have been settled there over the years for the purpose of demographic changes, by and large, remain there, although some have gone back to their original places. And that brings us to Article 140, which I will talk about later at the end. But I like to begin with challenges we face in Kirkuk. Of course, after 2003, a council was formed in Kirkuk, which was divided evenly between the different communities. This continued until 2004. And then in 2005, we had the national elections, which also happened in Kirkuk. And during that election, a new council was elected. In this council, which has 41 total members, 26 members belong to the Brotherhood list, which includes the main Kurdish parties and their allies. And it includes also Turkmens, Arabs, and Christians in it, but it's majority Kurdish. There were nine Turkmens in it and six Arabs. And of course, if you look at this, it really doesn't reflect the reality of population divide in Kirkuk, because we know for sure the Arabs are underrepresented in this council. Their numbers definitely will be more if there was full participation. And in 2005 election, there was partial participation by the Arabs. But nonetheless, this is the council that we're dealing with. This is the council that's running Kirkuk today, and this is the council that has recently elected a new chairman and also a new governor. So the challenge that's facing Kirkuk first is to have new elections. It's 6 years since the last elections. And actually, it's to the point that even the council members themselves feel that there should be a change and should be new elections. Some of them are bored and tired. Some of them, and the people, the population in Kirkuk feel like there should be elections and they should have new representatives. And the circumstances is totally different now than it was in 2005. Of course, in the past 8 years, and particularly since 2005, there has been periods of boycotting by different communities of the council meetings. Initially, the Arabs and Turkmens both boycotted. Then there was an agreement, and they came back. The question was power sharing by the different communities. The last agreement between the communities was the top positions in running Kirkuk should be divided in such that every community will be represented. And the agreement was for the highest represented list in the council to choose whatever position it wants, and then which will, in this case, it will be the governor, and of course the Kurds, having the highest list, picked up the governorship. The Arabs picked up the deputy governor position. The head of the council remained with the Kurds, but this was also a position that was always there for the Turkmens if they chose to come. And of course, this didn't happen until March of this year. And that was after the initiative by the Kurdish political leadership that things need to move forward in Kirkuk, because the way it was, particularly with the Turkmens, they felt that they really were not represented the way they should be. And it was creating a stalemate, a sense that they were not participants in this, where, when we all know that the Turkmens are original people in Kirkuk. They shared Kirkuk, particularly Turkmens and Kurds, for centuries. It was mainly a city where Turkmens and Kurds lived together. So the decision was made to have a change, and the was to offer the Turkmens the chairmanship of the council. We met with the Turkmens and offered them the position. They were happy about it. There was some issues between themselves because, as you know, unfortunately, in Iraq today, we have not only ethnic divisions, but we also have sectarian considerations and all that. But eventually that was settled. The Shia brothers wanted one of them to be the head of the council, whereas the Sunnis wanted one of their own. But eventually it was settled, and they all unanimously supported the new chairman. Since the new changes has happened, there is a new sense, really, that things are changing in Kirkuk. People generally feel better about the situation, particularly the Turkmen community, because this is the first time since a long time, not just 2003, that the Turkmens really have had a high-powered position within the Kirkuk governorate. We have met with their leaders. They come and we meet with them every day. We look and listen to their demands, and they have a lot of grievances. They have been subject to deportation, identity changes, and all kind of things. So they have really similar grievances as the Kurds do. As far as the Arabs are concerned, there was some objection as to these changes were made without consultation with them. And we sat with them and we told them that really this is just a completion of the arrangements that they have agreed upon. And it was that arrangement that they chose to pick the deputy governorship. So they had the position that they had picked themselves according to the agreement. But nonetheless, out of the six Arabs, three of them didn't come to the initial voting and swearing in ceremonies. But since then, they have come back, actually. They come to the governor's governorate office, and they participate in discussions and run their own things. And actually, they come to me a lot of times asking for help and services in their neighborhoods, in their districts. But officially, they still claim that they are not coming to the official meetings, which is every Tuesday. But overall, the feeling and the atmosphere in Kirkuk is significantly better and changed as far as communities working together than it was, say, 3 months ago. Of course, the challenge we have now, one of the really pressing issues that we have and we need to get to, is having new elections in Kirkuk. The new elections are important because in Kirkuk, we don't know which law we are using to run Kirkuk. All the other governorates outside the Kurdistan region, they have had the election laws last time. It specifies the authorities that the governor and the governing council has. Whereas in Kirkuk, some say, well, we don't have that because we didn't have elections. So some people are using the old Ba'athist regime laws, and some of them are using what is called Bremer's law. But the end result is really the authorities in Kirkuk and the people of Kirkuk, you are not to be blamed for this. It's really the politicians and the factions in Baghdad. They have not reached an agreement on how to have election, and that is affecting the people of Kirkuk. In Kirkuk, everything we do has to go back to Baghdad. And in Baghdad, there is so much bureaucracy and roadblocks that you can't really get things done in time for people to see and affect their lives. Recently, the UN representative, Ed Melkert, came to Kirkuk and had a meeting with different communities, with the governor, with the head of the council and deputy governor and political parties. And then he arranged for a meeting to occur in Baghdad between all the representatives in the Iraqi parliament. Unfortunately, that meeting did not happen. And I talked to our Turkmen and Arab friends who basically objected to the fact that KRG representative will be in that meeting. And I talked to them. I said, well, how could you refuse KRG to be there? I mean, we know for a fact that to find a solution for Kirkuk in the future, you have to have Kurdistan regional government participation. Well, they claimed that there were not enough consultation with them ahead of time, and that's why they did that. So we hope that next time, if there is a move to have elections in Kirkuk, that it will be such that there will be good preparation for it ahead of time instead of rushing it. Too much is made of Arab-Kurdish divide in Kirkuk, that this is a flashpoint, and if U.S. withdraws, that everything will blow up and Kurds will, and Arabs will fight each other. Well, I like to really differ with that opinion. Of course, I think U.S. presence is important. It's necessary for United States troops to stay in Iraq, and particularly in so-called disputed territories. It's important. But I think there has, if you go back historically and look at the relationship between the communities in Iraq, and particularly between Arabs and Kurds, it has never been really an ethnic divide. It has always been government regime oppression against the people. And I give you examples. In 1991, tens of thousands of Iraqi troops surrendered to the Kurdish forces, you know, after Saddam was defeated in Kuwait and evicted. And yet, there was no revenge against these soldiers who were almost exclusively Arabs, because the Kurds did really not serve in the Iraqi army before 1991. And when the city of Kirkuk was liberated by the Kurdish forces in 1991, there was no revenge against the people. I mean, they did not go and attack Arab homes, Arab neighborhoods, and rampant killing. That did not happen. In 2003, the same thing. You know, Kurdish forces went into Kirkuk before American forces got there, even into Mosul. But there was not such a thing as revenge killing against the people. I'm not saying excesses didn't happen, such as looting and other things, but there was no, like, going after Arabs and kill them. It's not what we saw really happen in Bosnia, for example. That never happened there. I don't think there is it's not a Kurdish-Arab conflict. It has always been a regime against the people. And the same regime that was killing Kurds really actually was killing Shia Arabs and was even oppressing Sunni Arabs who didn't agree with them. So I think there are too many things that bring the people together rather than divide them in Kirkuk. In Kirkuk, we have service needs. Every sector you look at it, there are needs: healthcare, education, roads, electricity, water. And everybody wants this. Kurds want it, Turkmen want it, Arabs want it, everybody wants it. And we all agree that we need these services. And actually, if you go to Main Street, that area that the explosions happened in yesterday, in the bazaar, in the center of the city, you see Arabs, Kurds, Turkmens, and actually the victims, if you look at them, the victims, even though it was mostly security and police forces, but it was it was spread along the ethnic lines, sectarian lines. It did not target one group. And if you look at what the terrorists do, they go to different places. They don't. They may focus on one area more than the other, but they really, wherever there is a soft and easy target for them, they go there, regardless of who lives there, what ethnicity, or what religion. We have a lot of things that unites us in Kirkuk. And one thing that is very important, really, that all Kirkukis look at is the Kirkuk is run by Baghdad. You all know that. I mean, they talk about KRG and all that, but really, KRG does not have influence as far as daily living and running things in the in different offices in Kirkuk, regardless of what it is. Perhaps maybe except some influence as far as security is concerned, and that is also done in coordination with the 12th Division, which is the Iraqi army, the Kirkuk police, the Americans, except for that. Other than that, every office in Kirkuk is run by Baghdad. And that is really a big challenge and a big problem that we're having. We get a budget for Kirkuk that we're supposed to spend with a specific time. If we don't spend that budget, it goes back to Baghdad. But if you look at the procedures that they put in there for us to do the work, it's so much by the time you give a project to a contractor or to a company to start it, it's really the end of the year has passed. And that's why you may have heard that money is going back to Baghdad because the Kirkuk authorities are not spending that money, which is really not true. I think my predecessor and the council before, they have done everything for them to be able to spend this money because the city is in dire need of that. But still, because of these regulations, they have not been able to do that. And if you talk to, I have talked to the political leaders from all the communities, and they all agree that this control from Baghdad over Kirkuk is really not serving Kirkuk. And the fact that we haven't had elections and we don't have the same rules don't apply to Kirkuk like the other governors has made things worse. And people are seriously thinking about, you know, loosening that attachment, you de-tethering Kirkuk from Baghdad. And that doesn't mean you attach it to something else, but loosening Baghdad's control over Kirkuk is really important to serve all communities in the city in a better way. And there is a consensus on that among Arabs, among Turkmens, and among the Kurds. Of course, when I talk about the three different communities, I also want everybody to realize we do have a small Christian community in Kirkuk that are truly part of what goes on. Actually, I have two assistants as governor, and one of them is from the Christian community, and he's actually very active and does the work. But of course, the numbers have dwindled because they were targeted by terrorists. However, their situation in Kirkuk has been much better than it was in Baghdad, Basra, or Nineveh province. But they still, of course, are threatened by them. So, you know, two things we need to work on is to go towards having elections and then to somehow loosen Baghdad's control over Kirkuk. I think that is impeding progress locally as far as the services, and it also, I believe, is impeding progress politically. I think once you get the services going, when you get the confidence-building measures such as, you know, extending services to every corner in the governorate, regardless of who lives there and what ethnicity or what religion they are, I think it will go a long way towards bringing people together. Once the people come together, I think politically it's easier to get into understanding rather than if somebody feels their neighborhood has been totally ignored because they are a specific ethnic group or religion or sect. So these are two important things. As far as the elections, what is preventing the elections? I think what's preventing elections is also because we have so many divides on other things, it's exacerbating the situation. But the main issue there is on voter list, who can vote in the elections in Kirkuk. That is, that's a contention, that's a point of contention. Before I came here, in my office, the head of the governing council was there and the deputy governor was there. And we were talking about elections. The deputy governor was saying, well, everybody who came after 2003 and whoever came during the process of ethnic cleansing, you know, the settlers who were brought in from other parts, should not participate in the elections. So my question was, well, my family was evicted from Kirkuk, and we are from Kirkuk, and now they have returned. You think they shouldn't vote? He says, no, those can vote because they were originally. I said, well, what are you talking about? But the point is, it's an argument. But if you sit down and have a logical and reasonable talk, I really think people will understand it. You just need to, we just haven't sat down in an atmosphere that is normal and relaxed and trying to find a solution rather than to take a posture to just show that you are tough or different than the others. I think we can find a solution for it. One thing that I have proposed and discussed with them was we had elections in 2010 for Iraqi parliament, and it's this election that has, it's based on this election that we have a parliament that's running the country, and we have a government that's running the country now. So if you don't recognize the people who voted in that election, that means your parliament and your government is illegitimate. So it really doesn't make sense to say, I don't expect that voter list. I think that's probably, you can make modification, but that's probably one of the best bases to build the election and to decide who can vote in this election. I think one of the problems we have really with not having elections and not having census, which is totally senseless if you look at it, because I mean, without a census, how can you build? How can you plan for the future? How can you do this? I think some of it is fear. Fear of what? Fear of, well, I have claimed that Kurdish population in Kirkuk is 5 million, for example. Well, if we have a census and all that, it probably will give you the accurate picture, and that's like an egg in your face, which I don't look at it that way. I think we should think in a way that it really doesn't matter what your number is, whether you are 10%, 15%, 50%, or 60%. I think your rights are the same as everybody in Kirkuk. And if people believe in that and people think that way, I think there's not going to be fear, because whatever we do, we have to run the city together. We have to run the governor together. Kurds are the majority in Kirkuk today. I mean, by all measures you look at it, they are majority. But can the Kurds impose their will on the rest of the people there? Absolutely not. I mean, even if it was 10%, let alone 45 to 49 or whatever percentage it is. So you can't do that. It has to be agreement. It has to be a consensus on most issues. And I really think this is possible. I think the belligerence that we have had there is monopoly by some people on some party politics to keep their position, to keep their, and of course outside influence and all that has affected this. But I think if you look at it, people are coming around and realizing that we need to move forward. We need to get together and get beyond this impasse that's there. So having the elections, having giving the delegate powers to Kirkuk and actually detethering Kirkuk from Baghdad, I think, are two very important issues. And then that brings me to Article 140. Article 140 is a successor to Article 58 of Transitional Administrative Law, which is TAL. And that specified how to deal with disputed territories. Of course, this article was put in the Iraqi Constitution in 2005. It consists of three phases: normalization, census, and referendum. The process of normalization is still going on. And unfortunately, I think it's Article 140 in a way is being diluted, you know. Now it's involving all of Iraq. It's the funding for Article 140 actually is $20 million less than this year than last year. But its scope has expanded to go to a lot of southern provinces. And we know there has been some changes there. But the changes that happen in Kirkuk, in Nineveh, and Diyala province, and Salah ad-Din, which was established later, are different. It was done for different reason. It's clear the intention was demographic changes, was a policy of ethnic cleansing and genocide. You have written very well about Joost in your Poisonous Affair and other things, that work you did on Anfal campaign. So what would we do? I think one thing that needs to be done here is the agreement that the Maliki coalition has signed with the Kurdistan List in the process of government formation in Baghdad. 19 points were given to Maliki, and actually not just Maliki, all the potential prime ministerial candidates that included Ayad Alawi, Jafari, Ahmed, whoever was a potential candidate. Of course, the two most serious candidates were Ayad Alawi and Nuri Maliki. They both actually agreed pretty much on the principles of implementing Article 140, but Maliki and his coalition, including the Sadrists, were more specific and were agreeable to the details. You know, there was a roadmap on how about to go and do that. And Maliki still states that he will abide by this agreement. He will abide by this agreement, and he will follow up on his promises. But in reality, things have not moved much forward. And as far as the second phase, which is the census, I mean, we haven't gone through the first. We're not agreeing on a census for all of Iraq that has nothing to do with politics, that has nothing to do with Article 140, that has nothing to do with disputed territories, and that has not happened. We had a meeting last fall in which the president, the prime minister, and representative of different branches of government and Ministry of Planning were there. There were no security problems to carry out the census. There were no logistical problems. Everything was ready. The disagreement came on one point, and that was ethnicity. You know, for ethnicity not to be listed, and you just count yourself. Well, if you look at census in Iraq over the years, it always had ethnicity in it. And we think ethnicity is important because, we have different communities. They live in different places. You have to know if you need a Turkmen school, an Arab school in a neighborhood that's predominantly Kurdish, and a lot of other things that's needed. And even in this country, you know, when you see your census form, it tells you black, white, Hispanic, others, and all that. And there, so. Again, I think that the reason for insistent on not having that may have to do something with people being afraid that their numbers are not as they claim. which shouldn't be really the issue. So what would we do about Article 140? I think we should complete the process of normalization. I think we should insist that the government in Baghdad allocate more funds for this and expedite the process to move beyond the first phase. But the eventuality, let's say the first and second phase is implemented, we still need to have some agreement between the communities as far as what happens at the end and what the vote will be on. Obviously the intent of Article 140 was these are territories, that the so-called disputed territories are part of Kurdistan. It has been separated by the separate regimes in the past, and the intent is for the people to be able to vote whether they want to join Kurdistan region or not. That's a very fair thing, and people are free to decide which way they vote. But even if there was a vote for, let's say there was a majority vote to join the Kurdistan region, I think there has to be things in it for the Turkmens, for the Arabs, and all that their rights will be respected within this region if they voted for that, or if they voted for a region by itself, what will it be? And this brings me to the point that the KRG itself should have a clear policy on what do they intend to do in the event that this happens. Well, you can't just bring Kirkuk and put it on Kurdistan region and say, well, people voted and that's it, and have business as usual, because Kirkuk is not Duhok, is not Erbil, is not Süleymaniye. Kirkuk is, has different communities in it. Those people have different needs. And we have had this discussion actually with the president of Kurdistan region, with Iraqi president, and with my colleagues in the leadership. So I think some clarification should be also given by the KRG. What will the relationship will be? I think Kirkuk should have a special status. This is my opinion, my personal opinion. Should have a special status within the KRG if that was the vote. There should be representation of different communities in Kirkuk within the KRG presidency, within the Council of Ministers, within the parliament. There should be allocation of seats based on the population of these communities in the Kurdistan parliament, for example. And these communities will elect their own representatives. It will not be picked by anybody else, but by their constituents. Then, of course, language and freedom of press, association, these are all granted in the Iraqi constitution, and its practice in Kurdistan should extend to those communities. And then perhaps we should even think about a period where after this happens that there will be a rotation of governorship, council chairmanship, and other important positions within Kirkuk. So these communities, when it comes to voting on the final stage of Article 140, people know what they are getting into. I think even Kurds probably want clarification, not just Arabs and Turkmen, as what their fate will be in the Kurdistan region. So I think these are steps that needs to be taken, and we have a lot of challenges ahead of us. Since I have been to Kirkuk, I just like to briefly tell you what few things we have done. I think that, like I said, the atmosphere is much better. The relationship between the communities are closer. We had a Kurdish governor and a Kurdish governing council chairman. Actually, they hardly spoke to each other. and by the way, when I went back and I looked at things, they said we're planning to build a governorate building. I said, where? They said, in the northern part of the city. I said, how about the governing council? They said, we will build that on Baghdad Road, which is in the southern part of the city. Well, you know, I mean, you could just see. Of course, we changed that. But that's how the relationship was. And today, I meet with the council chair probably twice a day. We see each other. He comes to my office. I run into his office. And we talk. The deputy governor is the same way. We have reestablished meeting of the directorates, you know, of the different directorates, directors of the offices every month. We meet every Monday at 9 o'clock to discuss, to coordinate actions, which was not going on. We have convened the security apparatus in Kirkuk, different, the 12th division, the police, the security, the military security, intelligence, and all of that, and actually even the Americans, they participate in that, and we have reconvened that, which is very important, because one of the problems in security there is really one side not knowing what the other is doing. So at least now we can coordinate and everybody knows. And if there are excesses or things need to be done and corrected, we do that. But security is a challenge. In Kirkuk, we have three main security threats: Al-Qaeda, Ansar al-Islam, and the so-called Naqshbandis, who are the remnants of the Ba'ath Party, loyal to Izzat al-Duri, the deputy to Saddam Hussein. The Al-Qaeda comes from areas contiguous with Mosul and Salah ad-Din province. And these are the ones who are responsible for the spectacular big suicide bombings that probably you hear about it in the news more than anybody else. They have had operations like this in Kirkuk, but it's not the most frequent thing that, in Kirkuk. We have the former Ba'ath, the Naqshbandis. These are situated in the district around Hawija and in Hawija, which is an Arab district west of Kirkuk. And they basically carry out assassinations with silencers. They go to people's homes and they target, government, particularly security officials, and also they kidnap for ransom. That's how they finance themselves. The most active of all the three is the Ansar al-Islam, or Ansar al-Sunnah used to be called. And these are basically concentrated in an area south of Kirkuk. It's called the Rashad Valley. And they are the ones who send the cars that park in front of restaurants, in front of shops, and places like that. And if somebody goes, drives their car to go buy something, they stick an IED to it, and then they detonate it whenever they want, whether it's in front of the house or in front of a shop or something. And really, they have been the most active and causing the most damage. And most of these, or almost probably 90% of these, they enter the city through the southern gate of Kirkuk. They get sheltered in certain areas, and actually the deputy police chief, who is a Turkoman, told me there are three villages, if they just allow us to go and put some security belt around it, we probably can cut down on the terrorist activities by 50%. This is Liwa Torhan, the deputy police chief. So we have all these challenges, and unfortunately, in the last 2 months, I think their activities has been on a rise. If you look at it, it has spiked the month of middle of March, April, and this month. It has spiked, and it's more than it was before. And we think that's probably related to the fact that we have some improvement in the political climate, and they just want to sabotage it and let people to believe that this is not going to happen. And of course, since Bin Laden killing, things may be getting worse as far as revenge is concerned. But we had actually the spike in terrorist activities even before Bin Laden's killing. I think I'm going to stop here to allow for questions. I'm sure other issues will come up. And I want to thank you again for listening.
No, thank you very much. This very comprehensive overview. I have a lot of questions, but I'll try to refrain from asking them right now and open the floor instead. Please identify yourselves, and there are microphones around. Yes. Down over here.
Daniel Sherwood from Johns Hopkins SAIS. I want to ask about the survivability or desirability of survivability of the confidence-building measures between the Peshmerga and the Iraqi army. The Americans have sponsored these mechanisms for the last, what, year or so. It now looks as if, because of Baghdad politics, not because of Kirkuk politics, that the Americans will be withdrawn. The question is, can these mechanisms survive? Should these mechanisms survive? Is there a real risk of instability because of conflict among the security forces?
Thank you.
And perhaps if you explain what the confidence-building mechanisms are.
Yeah.
Dane seems to think that everybody knows as much as he does.
Yeah. Well, currently, the way security is arranged between different security forces, a committee is formed or a center is formed where Iraq's 12th Division is basically outside the city of Kirkuk. It's in the periphery. They don't come into the city. The Peshmerga force, there is a brigade of Peshmerga, about 4,000 to 5,000, which is recognized officially to be there. They haven't come there and said we are here. They are recognized to be there, and they are in Karahanjir, which is just at the outside gate of the city of Kirkuk on the east side. And of course, you have the police. The Americans are there, so they coordinate things. There were some misunderstandings back in February, but since then they have formed this committee or this center, and they will be working. They are working together, and it's responsible for calling in more troops, whether it's Iraqi troops or Peshmerga or whatever, if there was a need, security need for that. Of course. In Kirkuk, there is a consensus that we really need and need the American forces to stay there at some capacity, at some number. And I have spoken to Turkmens, to Arabs. Everybody agrees on that. I don't think there's a disagreement on that. We feel that's necessary. It's not so much because we will have Arab-Kurdish fight or anything, but when you have a situation that has been maintained in this way, and all of a sudden the side that's everybody thinks probably is a broker here and brings everybody together and resolves disputes disappears, the relationship could change. So there is a potential for things to get worse without American presence there, we hope that they will stay. And the latest statements by Prime Minister Maliki actually is encouraging as far as troops remaining and agreement reaching. But the time is running out because we're talking about December 31st. We're about to start June 1st. So, and the military, U.S. military people tell me that this drawdown thing, you can't just stop it suddenly. You say it's November and now we have agreed and then you just stop it and troops will be redeployed or something. It's difficult. So an agreement has to be reached. And if you talking to the Iraqi political leaders in Baghdad, actually everyone individually, they want U.S. troops to stay. Everybody does, except for the Sadrists. But unfortunately, it's used politically. It's for political purposes. Everybody's throwing the ball into the other's court. Nujafi says it's the government's job to do this. Maliki actually, in his last statement, has been the most forthcoming. Alawi is using it for political reasons, and so there is no one with real courage to say, okay, we need this. Iraq cannot defend its borders. There's no question about it. I'm not a military person, but I've talked to them. I see them. I talk to them. Iraq cannot protect its skies. We don't have, there's nothing to protect the sky. So anybody can fly there and do whatever they want. And as far as internal security, we saw at any time, even with the American presence, just about a month or 6 weeks ago, you saw what happened in Tikrit. They took over the governorate building. They killed everybody. They took the whole thing. They take over prisons. They do it, even with Americans there. So really, Iraq is not ready. And it's not just in the interest of Iraq. I think it's in the interest of the United States also to stay. If things unravel there, it's the whole region. It's probably will become like Somalia or something like that. I don't believe in this, well, we can control ourselves and we want Americans out. I think that's disingenuous, and people should be a little bit more careful and have more courage about what we need there.
I'm Linda Wiest from the World Affairs Council in Houston. You haven't talked about energy, and I wonder if you could talk about the energy facilities and how secure they are, how development is proceeding.
In Kirkuk, we have fed the rest of Iraq for decades, but we haven't gained anything. I think for those who have come to Kirkuk often, Yost is one of them. As you come from Erbil, you see brown dirt, because everything burns away. You know, we have the natural gas burning away. They don't even give it to any company or anything. There's a lot of oil in Kirkuk still. Some people might think that it's drying up and all that. That's not the case. And there's about 15% of Iraq's oil still is exported from the fields in Kirkuk. There has not been maintenance and renewing those. From the experts that I talk to, they tell me that you could actually double production just from Kirkuk itself if there was a good maintenance and doing work on it. Nothing has been done since the Iraq-Iran war started on any of those fields, and new fields has not been discovered there. Kirkuk itself has not been getting anything from that oil. Saddam was spending it on arming and all of that, but last year, since the fall of last year, we finally were able to get $1 per each barrel that's exported from Kirkuk. So that's bringing us some revenue, which we didn't have before. Unfortunately, it's still Baghdad that dictates how we spend that money. You know, we can't really go ahead and say, well, this is our money. It is our money. It is our money by law. It's given to us. But they still control it in such a way that we don't. Of course, we like to get new companies to look for oil in Kirkuk. But we have new provisions with these things. Before, the environment was totally neglected as far as, you know, when these fields start and all that. We have issues with the energy in Kirkuk, particularly electricity issues. We're not getting what we need from Baghdad, and that might actually create tension and even conflict between Baghdad and Kirkuk. It happened briefly last year, but it could very well happen again. And if that happens, it can really lead to some significant conflict and disruption of how things are done with regard to energy in Kirkuk. Just before I came here, I met with the electricity minister. They're not very forthcoming, so when I get back, we will talk to them, and hopefully we find a solution for this. But it's a serious problem.
Yes, please.
I'm Hanan Zalwani Idrisi from the National Endowment for Democracy. You've talked a lot about service delivery and how that is important in Iraq. And in view of this, we have seen how Iraqis have took the streets. taking the streets to express their concerns about corruption, governance, and especially service delivery in the country in general. As far as Kirkuk is concerned, I'd like to ask, how is the response of the Kurdish regional government echoing in Kirkuk as far as the protests that have been taking place in Sulaymaniyah? Because the Kurdish regional government response has been disappointing so far to the protesters from one hand. And from the other hand, how is also the 100 days frame time that Maliki has promised to take some measures regarding service delivery in the country is also echoing in Kirkuk? Thank you.
Yeah. Well, protests in Iraq in general, if you look at it, hasn't been any really, and I'm not minimizing what has happened, but it hasn't been even close to what we have seen in Egypt, in Tunisia, in Libya, in Syria, in Yemen. But we have had, if you look at the protesters in Tahrir Square, for example, I mean, they come, but the numbers, it's not great numbers that people come out. And you have, I think we have to realize one thing. The government system in Iraq is totally different than those places. So that's why probably we don't see that. The complexion is different in Iraq than, you know, as far as ethnic and sectarian components are totally different. But nonetheless, there is no question people have legitimate demands. You know, they need electricity, they need clean water. Unemployment is one of the really biggest challenges that Iraq faces today, including Kirkuk. We have a lot of young people who graduate and they don't have jobs. And unfortunately, the investments so far, generally speaking, has not encouraged, it's not the type of investment that can create jobs. It's, you know, building apartments, homes and hotels and all that, which helps a little bit, but it's not the type that encourages employment. And that's really, it's like a vicious cycle. When you have more employed, then more people get appointed to government jobs, which means, you know, you're increasing the size of bureaucracy several folds, which leaves you less money for rebuilding in a country that's in so much need of rebuilding, whether it's roads, housing projects, factories, reviving your oil and energy sector and all that. But there are legitimate demands. You know, people need that. Our healthcare system is in shambles. It's absolutely, completely dysfunctional in any way you look at it. Education, there are no schools, no school buildings. In one school, you have in one building, you have four different schools, actually, in shifts. It's so bad. You know, in the winter, it gets leakage if it rains. And in the summer, it's hot. You know, it's just not an environment for learning. And these are really problems. And, of course, there's issue of corruption. Issue of corruption is real. I think some organization ranks countries in order, and Iraq ranks second after Somalia, which is a shame, really. So we have these real issues. The 100 day, I think the 100 days is unrealistic thing. You can't really do. I think that was just a impulsive response to what was going on, but you can't do this with 100 days. We don't really have a government that's functioning normally, that's planning how to do things. I mean, the government is not even completely formed. Actually, some even talk about the government even falling and then starting all over again. Well, you know how long it took to form this incomplete government, you know. So, but we have real issues, and protests are not. I mean, if people have the right to protest, but also, you know, you have to have laws to protect protesters, but laws also to protect people's properties, government properties. I mean, it's important. In Kirkuk, we really haven't had any significant issues with protests. We haven't.
Thank you. I think I'll try. I'll take advantage of the prerogative of the chair and ask put in a question myself. You have stressed a lot this issue of this very dysfunctional relation between Kirkuk and Baghdad, that all the decisions go back to Baghdad, that you cannot spend the money that you have either from oil revenue or what is allocated by the government and so on. And this is a complaint that you hear more and more around the Iraq. You have a special problem in the sense that you don't have the provincial council, the elected provincial council that other regions, that other provinces have, and so on. But what we are beginning to see around the country is demands for the creation of new autonomous regions, essentially. Provinces that start talking, I don't know how seriously, probably not terribly at this point, but setting forth the idea that they would be better off if they were part of an autonomous region. Is this happening in Kirkuk, or is the dominant demand essentially still that of becoming part of the KRG?
Well, I think you're absolutely right as far as, Basra has been wanting to become a region by itself. Recently, Mosul, Salahuddin, and Anbar, and half of Baghdad, not only become a region, but they have even talked about uniting and separating from Iraq as a whole. So. So that is something that goes on in Kirkuk. Obviously, in Kirkuk, in Diyala, and in Nineveh, with Salahuddin province, you have territories that's disputed as far as where it belongs to and where it should be. I think ultimately the decision on that will be by the people who live in those places. And if you look at the UNAMI report that De Mistura prepared at that time, it shows you the historical changes and how it happened. Unfortunately, it was really, I think it's one of the best documents as far as documenting what happened. But unfortunately, there was no recommendation what to do with it at the end, at least not that I could see. I think if you talk to the majority of the Kurds today, they probably—I'm not going to hide it—that they would want to join Kurdistan region, to be part of the KRG. But again, we are looking for something to work out. Some people have brought up the question of actually separating Kirkuk. For example, those predominantly Arab districts that has only Arabs in it, maybe they should, and even some of the Arabs has demanded that, they should form their own governorate or their own region, and then the rest of Kirkuk with Kurds and Turkmens deciding a separate way. But that is something, you know, we haven't reached a point of decision on that. Like I said, Article 140 is still in its first phase, and that's the fault of the government in Baghdad. It's not going through the process and the promises that they have cut with the people. But I think as far as having regions for themselves, particularly wealthy governorates such as Kirkuk, such as Basra, some other places where they have oil and all that, of course they want to be able to run their own affairs and not have Baghdad controlling them, just like in this country. I think all the states wants to have more control over their things and less interference by the federal government in Washington. I think the same sentiment goes. But then you have poor states or poor governorates. They like, because they get a share of from other people and get it, which may be fair, and that's why in this country we had two senators from each state, big and small, they are the same. So
More questions? Yes, yes. Your name has been invoked often enough. You almost have to.
No, rules every day. That's right. Najmuddin. Yost Kasam, the International Crisis Group. Sorry about that.
Everybody knows Yost.
So. No.
We have some visitors from out of town. Yeah, so that's why I'm insisting.
I guess a couple of questions. One was, you mentioned that there had been no demonstrations in Kirkuk, and that's largely true, of course. It's also because curfews were imposed preemptively by the local authorities, maybe wisely so. But what happened in February after the demonstration started in Sulaymaniyah, Kurdish forces came into Kirkuk. You mentioned earlier there were some misunderstandings in February. Kurdish forces came into Kirkuk and moved in areas where they were not supposed to have been deployed. And it took basically a month of negotiations and pressure from the United States for these troops to be moved out again. And this raises the question of what comes after American troops leave, because it is true that, from my experience anyway, the people in Kirkuk don't want American troops to leave, but it looks like they might very well leave. And so I'm a little bit concerned about unilateral moves by either side, or any side, or other violent actors who are out there that you've already listed, to make a grab for Kirkuk or to make trouble in Kirkuk. When the opportunity exists. So I'm a little bit more concerned about this than you seem to be, and I just want to flag that and see what your response to that is. The second question is about the energy matter, because you also mentioned that Kirkuk field could maybe double in production. Well, that's probably true, but the reason it hasn't been rehabilitated is because no major oil company has any interest in moving into the Kirkuk oil field. Because of the unresolved status of the governorate, and also the fact that the Kirkuk field itself is divided in sovereignty between the Kurdistan regional government, which has part of it, and the Baghdad government, which has another part of it. No company in its right mind will develop a field that it has not full control over, where you have to have basically a negotiation between two governments over how this will be managed. Now, maybe that negotiation can take place, but it hasn't. So what do you see the energy future for Kirkuk as long as the status of the area remains unresolved?
Yeah. First, as far as the security is concerned, I mean, the issue of February 25th, it's true, we had curfew that day, and we had to have curfew that day because there was clear threats from groups that they will attack Kirkuk, take over the governorate building and burn it down, take over political party buildings and burn it down. These were clear threats, and they were not joking. And actually, they did it in Hawija. They took over the district building. They did it in Mosul. Actually, the speaker of the Iraqi parliament and his brother were trapped in a building that was burning in Mosul on that day. So it was real. It wasn't just a bluff or anything. So that happened. And it was actually that threat that caused the Kurdish leadership to move part of that brigade that's in Karahanjir to that southern gate where the threat was coming from. And that decision was conveyed to Prime Minister Maliki, and I was the one who was authorized to talk to him. So he was aware of it. The 12th Division commander was aware of it. They were all aware of it, and it happened. And fortunately, nothing happened. Some demonstrators came that day, several hundred. We talked to them. They dispersed. They had some legitimate demands and grievances. They dispersed, and nothing happened. And then after that, of course, gradually, they started withdrawing to their original places. A small force remained there. And after negotiation and U.S. intervention, they went back. Now they have that center that they have formed within the base. That includes all the different components of the security to deal with this issue. And actually, one of the major threats that was there, and on the day, on the 24th and 25th, I went and visited with a colleague of mine, the Turkmen Front offices, and we told them what was going on, and they were really happy we were doing this. They would not say it publicly, but they said, we understand it, we feel it's necessary. The threat was there. Because the Turkmens are probably, after the Christians, are the ones who are more vulnerable to these things, because they don't have any forces of their own to defend them and all that. And there were clear instructions to the Peshmerga forces not to enter the city, and they did not, and also to make sure they protect the Christian and Turkmen communities, because that was one of the threats they were using to attack these and blame it on the Kurds. And so the conflict will start between inside the city itself. Unfortunately, none of that happened. Americans might leave. I hope they stay. But that's why we need to move on and move the process a little bit, as far as elections, as far as even making progress on Article 140 and how to move it before final American departure. And I think even if the military left, there will still be significant American presence in Iraq. You know, probably forces to protect the embassy, probably. I know they will have a civilian council in there, and they have there will be some American presence, I'm sure. But we have to look at it, or assume that they will be leaving. That's why I think it's urgent to go ahead and make progress on the elections, on the census, on all of these issues. I think it will help the situation. If they stay, that's great. You have done something good, and it will stay. As far as the energy is concerned, and Joost, you know that in the agreement that was signed in February of 2007, all the existing fields will be run by the federal government. All the existing fields. So whatever was in Kirkuk before 2003 and was producing is run by the federal government. The newly discovered fields will be run by the region, whether it's Basra, KRG, or even Kirkuk, actually. So whatever existed before, Iraq has control over it. And of course, even the ones that are in the Kurdistan region, Iraq gets the revenue from it, and I think there was a positive development in the last week when Iraq, for the first time, agreed to pay the oil companies, $400 some million, I think. This was a positive development, and I think it will be encouraging to the companies. And as far as you're right. I think when a company wants to come and invest and put its money in some place, they want to make sure that who they are dealing with. And of course, security is important. But I think basically in what is Kirkuk today and all the fields that what is the governorate of Kirkuk today and the oil and energy that's being produced is all under control of the federal government. But that's outside the Kirkuk governorate. It's
outside Kirkuk, but it's the Kirkuk field.
But it's
one geological structure.
Yeah. But it's not the governorate boundary.
I know.
Yeah.
It's a complication.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing with the whole disputed territories. Not just that. But that's outside. I'm just talking. But technically speaking, it's outside. You know, listen, don't get me wrong. I like for all the territories that has been cut from Kirkuk to return to Kirkuk, and including the energy and everything, including Chamchamal, Tuz, Kifri, Kalar, all of those. I mean, Kirkuk is probably 55% what it used to be. Kirkuk was the fourth largest city or largest province in Iraq. Now it's way down the list. So, I mean, but that's an issue that really goes with the resolution of the disputed territories, I think, yeah.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
My name is Connie Zulama. I'm with the American Kurdish Information Network. My question is, If you were to take a walk in Hilla or Najaf or Basra and listen to the people, I mean, what's their perception of the legitimacy of the Kurdish aspirations? Do they accept the Kurdish demands or Kurdish hopes and aspirations, or do they reject, you know, the legitimacy of the Kurdish demands?
Before you answer, since we are running out of time, are there any other questions? If there are, I'll take them together. Yes, sir.
Dr. Karim, I am a surgeon myself, and I had a great opportunity to work with him for several years. And operating on illness which is natural and very predictable, but now you are operating a governance, and it's very unpredictable, and it sounds like a minefield. What I want to know is, there is a vision, I'm sure you're carrying it, of a society with good governance, transparency, works on meritocracy, with a good social capital. Besides in this minefield you are operating on, are you working to evolve the culture of the society in which these elements can come together? And we can diffuse these crisis situations.
Okay. I don't see any other hands.
Well, Kani, you know, you talk about Kurdish aspirations. I wasn't sure exactly what, but what is existing now in Iraq? You know, obviously, if you look at the history of relationship between Kurds and Iraqi government, as you know, Iraqi Kurdistan was annexed to Iraq, and it was really never part of Iraq. But that's a fact; it's there. Initially, there was skepticism about accepting federalism and Kurdistan region as a federal region by a lot of people. But in the constitution, it was decided. On that, and it was accepted. It's in the Iraqi constitution. Prior to that, the opposition to Saddam Hussein also was accepting of the fact that there will be federalism and Kurdistan region is a federal region by itself. I think that has been really accepted by and large. Even people who before you refused to mention the word Kurdistan, now it's very normal. They do it. And if you're talking about separating from Iraq, if that's what you mean by aspiration, I think there are those who will probably accept that and say, okay, if they want to go, let them go. But I think the majority probably still is accepting of what is there now and probably will not. This is my personal thing, just having been in the parliament and talking to people. I don't think the majority will understand why you should separate from Iraq, but they will accept within Iraq proper. I think they have actually accepted it. We get 17% of the revenue. You know, Kurdistan region. You know, it has its own dealing with the outside world. Every official that comes to Baghdad for important reason goes to Erbil. So that has been accepted. And I think, you know, we hope that this will work out. We hope that this will work out. Iraq will prosper and progress democratically. This is fine. I think the people in Kurdistan are also accepting of this. Of course, there are issues we still need to resolve. And hopefully we don't run into any major conflict like we had in the past. Really, nobody benefited. Nobody has won anything when we were fighting each other, when people were getting killed and all that. Nobody benefited from that, you know. So we hope that. But overall, this takes me back to my first point that I made. I really don't think there is a Kurdish Arab conflict. I don't. I don't think there is a Kurdish-Arab conflict. I think it has always been government, how it dealt with its people. And as long as within Iraq proper, I think the people has accepted that. they have. With regard to my friend Dr. Khan, you know, we have done so many operations together over the years, really great cases. The other day I was telling a friend of mine, I said, when I was on call, I'm a neurosurgeon, when I was on call, I was only on call for my patients and for my hospital. But now I have to be on call for every hospital, the police, the everything. So it's really totally a different thing. But I think the experience as a surgeon also helps because, and as a physician, because one thing we do is in our work is you listen to people, and I really think that's very, very important to listen to them, so you can diagnose what the problem is and you can find you can manage it better, and I think a physician is probably positioned better than anybody else to do that, because I mean half of what we do with the patient is listen to them and then go explain things to them, and this is something that lacks, you know, politicians really lack in Iraq. They really do. I think if you go, the major complaint people have is there is a big gap or a very high wall between those who are running things and those who you're supposed to serve and talk to. So we're working on that, and hopefully we'll do our best. That's all I can tell you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.